Welcome to that.
Thank you.
And it looks like we're starting at about 10:10.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to go around the table so that you know who everyone is.
Great.
And we might have, as Joel said, one more person.
Okay.
So I'm Alexis Simmendinger, and I'm with the FDIC, mm-hmm. and I'm part of the writing team.
Hi, I'm Donna Norman. I'm also with the FDIC.
Joel Miller at CIC on the research team.
Steve Sandiford, I'm with the FCIC, on detail from the Richmond Fed, working on the research team.
Yes, I've worked with Steve before.
Yes.
One of the things I think that they like to do to warm everybody up is to go through the short version of their CVs.
Yes, that would be good.
Would that be all right? Absolutely, but does somebody want to give him the ground rules?
Oh, sure, go ahead.
It's just a housekeeping. Just so you know, the FDIC was statutorily created. We are an arm of the congressional branch. Our objective is to investigate the causes of the financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
We have 22 specific objectives to do that. We are federal agents as members of the FDIC, which means we are subject to you're subject to perjury. So. Obviously, you'll tell the truth today. We appreciate that.
Sure.
Thank you for coming. We just want to make sure you know what we're doing. Our main objective is to write a report on the causes of the financial mm-hmm. crisis and the collapse or near collapse
mm-hmm.
of major U.S. institutions. That report mm-hmm. is due December 15th. So we're in a hurry, and we really appreciate you being here.
Well, my pleasure. So could I get a sense of everyone's background? I know Steve's and...
Sure, I'm on a detail from the OCC. I'm with the asset management group there, and until very recently reported to Kathy Dick.
Oh, yeah, she just left.
Things are happening. But my focus historically has been asset management.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Donna, and I'm on detail. I work for the SEC.
Okay.
And I am a journalist, part of the writing team.
Okay.
So I'm the everyman in the room.
Okay. Very good. All right. So,
summarize your
CV, okay.
And then everybody will start with questions.
Sure. So I was with the Fed for about a little over nine years. Joined in 2001. I headed the credit risk function at the Fed, assistant director there. And prior to the Fed, I was on the private side, worked for Citi Bank and in New York, and then Peregrine Capital in Hong Kong, and then Fleet, Roberts and Stevens in Boston, and then more recently, I just joined Deloitte and charged with building out their credit risk advisory function. And
when did you join Deloitte?
About 4 weeks ago.
4 weeks, okay.
Mm-hmm. How long were you at Citigroup?
I was there from 1990 to 95 or 6, I think, yeah.
And Peregrine, you were there?
95 or 6 through 98. I started my own business. I forgot to mention that.
How'd that go?
Miserably.
And your education?
I'm a BS in chemical engineering, and I have an MBA.
And your BS is?
He's from Rutgers, mm-hmm. and an MBA from Carnegie Mellon.
So chemical engineering helps with toxic acids.
Well, you know, finance can get pretty technical, and... But at Carnegie Mellon, I actually thought I had an advantage because it was a fairly technical program over the psych majors and economics majors that were, but it was not the case. They just approached the problem in a different way, but came to the same answer.
What did you gravitate, just out of curiosity, from chemical engineering to business?
Well, right out of college, it was the chemie market was very tough. So, in an insurance company hired me out of school,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted me to go visit their plants that they insured to make sure they didn't blow up. So, through my different plant visits, I noticed that key decision makers were not the engineers, it was actually the finance people. So I decided to go do my MBA, and then I noticed during my 2 years, investment banking was all the rage, so I went into that.
Interesting.
Housekeeping matter, you mentioned you joined the Voight 4 weeks ago. Was that directly from Ben?
Yes.
Can you tell us what you do with the Fed, what you did with the Fed?
So as assistant director over there, basically my role was to oversee the credit risk activities conducted by the banks, make sure that they were done in a safe and sound manner. So the board delegates the authority of supervision to the Reserve Banks. And so my role was to work with all the examiners, credit risk examiners in the system. There was about 1,000 or so. Make sure that we give them guidance on key issues to focus on in the banking system. Develop policies on emerging risks that we think examiners should focus on. And also provide technical expertise when needed. So I had a group of 11 or so people that sort of had very specific expertise in various areas of credit risk. So credit risk can be carved up into multiple areas, such as commercial real estate, C&I, which is leveraged loans, typically credit derivatives, and then sort of internal capital assessment. So different people had different expertise, and so whenever there was an issue from the Reserve Banks, our examiners, our banks for that matter, we would provide sort of the regulatory perspective of the expectations of what examiners or banks should be doing.
Did you work at Washington?
Yes.
Can I follow on that? Can you give me an idea of the glide path that got you into risk? In other words, how the Fed came to hire you? Because you weren't a bank examiner at
No.
Can you just describe?
Yeah, so at Fleet, I was involved in credit derivatives. Mm-hmm. So Fleet at the time was, I think, number 5 in the league tables of doing deals in credit derivatives. So Fleet, I was on the credit derivatives desk. I did other things at Fleet as well, but that was an area they started. And so that area intrigued me because it looked like it was on credit, which I liked. And then it had to do with capital and risk management. And so there was a restructuring at Fleet, and so I had the option of doing equity derivatives after the restructuring, or go to Asia and do leverage loans, or take a 1.5 year package and do something else. So Washington, I grew up in Washington. I went to high school. My parents are here, and so I thought this would be a good time to come down to Washington and focus. I was interested in capital and credit and. So I just interviewed with someone here, and it was right at the time when I was thinking about what to do at Fleet, and so it just happened. It was a sort of a random event that happened in a way, and I thought I'd be there for 2 years and then go back to Wall Street, but I really ended up liking it.
Did you have a variety of jobs at the Fed, or were you assistant director?
No, I started off as an analyst, supervisory analyst, and then was promoted a few times, several times.
And what were you analyzing?
I was analyzing credit risk. I started in the credit risk area. So in a way...
at specific banks or...
Well, overall, the function was the same. Instead of me heading it, I was actually one of the analysts in the division. So it started off with a 2-person group. So me and another analyst and David Wright, who hired me, was the manager at the time, and we expanded it.
So it was sort of new to have that team?
It was, I think, Credit Risk, so I don't know the entire history behind it, but I think Credit Risk was amalgamated with other risk functions. And I think in reorg at the time, they decided to sort of segregate the different risk functions because credit risk is such a big component in itself, along with market risk, credit risk. Mm-hmm. And then they later on had operational risk and compliance risk. Mm-hmm. So
who did credit risk report to?
Credit risk reported to... I was an assistant director, so then there was an associate director who was in charge of risk overall. So that person had credit, market, ops, and compliance. And the associate director reported to either the deputy director or the director directly.
And who was your associate director from 2004 through 2009?
It was a combination of David Wright and John Greenlee. David left to join the San Francisco Reserve Bank, and I think he's in charge of a large bank supervision there now.
I think that's correct.
Yeah. And
which of the deputies was in your reporting line?
Well, it was Steve Hoffman and then Deborah Bailey. And then there was a vacuum after that, after Deborah left.
Mm-hmm. So we kind of had some questions that we worked up with Greg.
Mm-hmm.
You know, beyond just writing the book, there's kind of, Greg got me charged up about, you know, these interviews and all will one day be available for researchers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Sure.
I mean, you're kind of in your role and position with Credit Risk. You've kind of been in the middle. So kind of telling the story is mm-hmm. really helpful. So mm-hmm. that's kind of, I think, what these questions and mm-hmm. kind of some of the things that I'm thinking about.
Sure.
What were we thinking? Mm-hmm. I'm out there looking at mm-hmm. securitization structures, and you know, we all were at the time. What were the developments?
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of want to focus in on some of the things that Greg kind of laid out in terms of the thought process. Big high level question to start: what caused the crisis?
Well, I mean, you know, in my view, there are a number of variables, and I don't think there's an easy answer to it, but I'll try to simplify it. One is the perception that AAA risk is very safe, and, you know, the whole, obviously, the capital arbitrage between, securitizing and holding on books, that also played a role. The demand for yield, looking for yield, and the lack of new products created a certain level of innovation that drove these new CCDO structures, and plenty of liquidity in the system. I mean, the U.S. was just being pummeled with investors from all around the world, and we had to try to do something with that liquidity. And so I think part of it was this origination of mortgages, and with this excess liquidity, and competition drove a decrease, a deterioration in underwriting standards that ultimately resulted in the origination of a lot of toxic assets. And I think those were some of the factors. Obviously, you know, people will talk about the low interest rate environment, and that sort of contributed to the search for yield. And so a AAA CDO structure would pay, you know, 30, 40 basis points than any other CDO structure. And, you know, people, I think, didn't really do their homework, but they saw the AAA name attached to it. And, you know, that was part of it. Another part was, you know, the democratization of credit that allowed many people to own homes that otherwise would not have been able to own homes. So I think many people did support the notion of innovation in the mortgage market that allowed you know, masses to own homes other than they otherwise would not have been able to. So the concept of interest only, which was traditionally for sort of people with variable income, you know, became available to many people, and as well as sort of the no-doc loans, which was really available to certain businesses, again, became available to the masses. So, you know, those are some of the, I think, key issues that drove the I think, the ultimate financial crisis. It was just, I think, competition and deterioration in underwriting standards, I think, was part of it. And that had to do also with the originate-to-distribute strategy, where banks felt that even if they originated, you know, loans and exposures, that they wouldn't keep on their books. If they sold it off, then, you know, they're okay. Yes. And that was, as you know, was a philosophical debate among regulators, too, that, you know, if these risks were being sold off to the market, the banking system would be safe at the end of the day. And so I think... And there was a debate about that. Nobody really had the right answer to that.
Maybe digging a little bit deeper on that piece, you know, and others have said the same thing. As a bank examiner, as a CPC, as a risk leader, you're looking at the originate to distribute model. I mean, what at the time leading up to the crisis? How were, you know, scarce resources, credit risk examiners allocated in the large institutions and across the country?
Well, I think the regulatory focus shifted on processes and controls and not on actual transaction testing and looking at the underwriting. So, you know, our whole philosophy... relied on whether the banks themselves had the right policies and procedures and the controls. And so that's where the resources were focused on. And not on, let's say, adequacy of capital, looking at, you know, what the underwriting was and so forth. And so, so the resources were assigned towards, process controls, which is important, but I think in that sort of focus, we you know, didn't really talk about some of the micro issues or emerging risks that were occurring in the environment.
There was never a debate about whether you all had allocated your resources adequately as things developed.
There is a resource allocation is always a discussion, but. It's based on the areas of priority. So we would prioritize different areas of focus and then try to allocate resources based on those areas of focus. And so resource allocation is an issue every year. Mm-hmm. So that's always been a discussion, but it was a matter of whether we saw you know, the spillover effects of the subprime market, for instance, being only 10% of the mortgage market, and whether we really identified that early on and put the right resources to really understanding that. But, you know, it was, our focus was on, let's say, something else, you know, Basel II, for instance, was a big focus, and making sure.
You say it was a matter of whether you identified the spillover effects. Do you think the Fed did identify the spillover effects?
I think there was there were different parts of the institution again had some mixed signals. So we my group did conduct a survey early on back in 2005 or 6. I forget the exact date. So The survey was very alarming. There was an interagency joint effort with the OCC and the FDIC, but the Fed led it. And it showed a very rapid increase in the volume of sort of these irresponsible loans, or very risky loans. And we did raise it up through the channels, and it took a while for the guidance to be issued on non-traditional mortgages, but we got tremendous pushback from the industry, as well as Congress, as well as internally. Nobody was convinced that this was a major spillover event. I do have to give credit to Chairman Greenspan and Roger Ferguson at the time, who if I remember correctly, Greenspan was trying to increase the rates because he was concerned about this housing bubble. But the long-term rates remained relatively flat, and the market continued to grow very aggressively. So they actually called us in and said, you got to issue this guidance.
Who's they?
It was Roger Ferguson, but I imagine the chairman was behind it.
About when was that?
This was back in 2005 or so.
And you mentioned that you were getting pushback. This had it gone interagency yet in 2005, or was it still?
Actually, the OCC was actually thinking about issuing this guidance on mortgages. They're talking about issuing guidance on mortgages.
So then, where was the pushback coming from? Pushback, Congress?
So once we did the survey, we had to first really understand what was going on. So there was OCC talked about issuing this guidance.
Can you stop and describe the survey just so we know what it was?
The survey went to seven or some odd institutions, six or seven, and they were the leading originators of the country, and I think they represent close to 30-40% of the market share of the country. And the survey tried to identify key underwriting trends.
This is all self-reported. In other words, you asked them.
Yes, right.
No one planned.
No.
Okay, it was just
their own version of, our examiners obviously verified it, whether it made sense or not. So our examiner, we didn't just say, but it made sense to us, and our examiners from each institution kind of validated what they submitted. And the results showed, again, a rapid increase. There was a lot of non-traditional mortgages, which included a lot of risk layering, that was essentially second loans or investment type loans, low doc loans, high CLTVs, that's cumulative loan to values.
Yes.
And so our survey suggested that this was rapidly increasing, and it was growing even further.
Can I ask you a question? You said seven or so institutions. Mm-hmm. Did you ask more than that and you only got seven to participate?
No, that was our target.
So they all responded in one way or another?
Yeah, so let me just think who they were. They were Countrywide, Wells, City, JPMC, Washington Mutual, that's five, Wachovia, yeah, I think, and IndyMac might have been the other one. Okay, seven, yeah.
So Ben, can I ask, did we have specific sort of parameters that, like FICO score, CLTV, beyond? So we specified.
Yeah, please give them, in this FICO score, what were the sort of underwriting statistics? And so through that mechanism, we saw a growing, through that survey, we saw a growing sort of origination pattern in the lower FICO bands. But also in the high FICO bands, we saw these interest-only loans, and which is really sort of been the problem in the last 2 years. Three or four years ago, it was a subprime. Then the Alt-A came after that.
Quick question on from the results of this, you mentioned they were very alarming.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, when you saw the survey results,
yeah.
Did you think there would be spillover effects from this?
I don't think we couldn't imagine the kind of spillover effects that ultimately happened, but it was very concerning from a regulatory perspective on the speed and potential magnitude of the problem, potential magnitude, if the speed at which it was growing could end up.
When you got the results and you sent this up to chain, it had a cover report or assessment, right?
Yeah, we developed a PowerPoint. We went to the board. We went to.
You did.
We did, and and then we had to present it to other presidents of the Reserve Banks. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember what it was that you concluded, or how you put it up that you do?
Yeah, one of the main conclusions is we had to go back to basics, because a lot of loans were being originated without really testing the ability to repay. And so, relying on collateral day one is a fundamental flaw in credit risk. If you're going to originate loans and rely on the repayment of the loan on collateral itself, that's not how loans should be originated. And that's how the markets are migrated towards, because the ultimate repayment was going to be from the appreciation of the home and when the borrower would sell the home and then repay the loan. People or banks were not necessarily, and a large part, there were a lot of fraudulent loans as well, and that came from the broker market.
Was that flagged, or did that come up in the survey, or how did you find out about the fraud?
Well, we didn't know about the fraud at the time. We couldn't, this independence of dealing with brokers and originating who was going to give the loans, provide that was an issue that we highlighted.
So it's fair to say that what you presented was a strong suspicion that this had to be occurring, right?
Yes. There were some risks. We saw some risks on third-party originations. We saw the risk that you got to be able to test the borrower's ability to repay. That was one of the key tenets that we put in the expectation.
Mm-hmm. So why was there pushback to a presentation that said, here's what we found and we need to go back to basics?
Because it was stifling innovation, potentially. And it was denying the American dream to many people.
Who said that?
I can't remember that.
Many
years ago.
This was 2005?
Mm-hmm.
Was this at the board that you, when you were making presentations at the board, or was it outside of the board?
It was in the board.
Okay.
And then I forget the exact sequence of events, but you know, when we issued the draft guidance, we then got pushback from the industry and I think Congress as well. Certain
and members. The draft guidance that went out as a proposal,
comment. It was from right. It went out as public right. comment.
And you definitely see those types of comments in the response.
And then going back to the board, and you said you briefed the presidents of the 12 reserve banks.
Well, not the full 12. There was this president's meeting, and there were a number of presidents there, yeah.
So how did they react to it, the reserve banks?
It was a mixed bag.
Are there minutes of this presentation?
I don't know.
Are there usually minutes of those presentations?
Maybe. I'm sorry, being vague. I really don't know.
If we wanted to ask more about that, who should we talk to?
You can ask Dave Caperton. Yeah, and there may not be minutes for that.
Along those housekeeping issues, a couple questions. Did you create it?
Did I create what?
The PowerPoint presentation.
Yes.
So it was your creation.
Yes.
And if we wanted to ask specifically for copies of the survey that went out
The
results that came back.
We have it. I mean, they have it.
And is there a specific name that we should ask for? I take it you... issue surveys a lot. We want to make sure we got exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So, specific name we should ask for it by.
Mm-hmm.
Make our job a little easier so we don't get.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the appropriate thing to do is to go through David Caperton.
Oh, absolutely. I'm just asking you if there's a specific survey that is called, if it has a specific name.
Yeah, oh, I see.
I'm asking for it by name.
Right.
Surveys
you call it the, you can call it the non-traditional mortgage survey.
Okay.
And,
up to them.
Oh, right around there. People will know exactly what that is.
There were two sets of guidance. First, there was specifically around non-traditional mortgage. First, non-traditional mortgage, and then its follow-on guidance that was non-traditional mortgage and subprime lending.
Subprime.
So if we can get the exact sequence of events, I understand that.
Right.
10 years ago, I can't remember, so the exact dates.
So what had happened is that people thought that our expectations in the guidance didn't apply to 328s, which was our 228s, which was subprime mortgages, right? And so we had to go back and then basically say the same things, essentially, that we said in non-traditional mortgages, to the subprime mortgage for subprime mortgages. And by that time, things have already sort of matured quite a bit.
When you say people thought it didn't apply, was it intended to apply subprime mortgages?
The spirit of having been the drafter of the non-traditional guidance, I would say the spirit in intent was it had applied to those types of loans. The language that we put in the guidance itself, I think, allowed the market to interpret that it did not include 228s.
Do you consider that intentional or oversight?
I think it was an oversight.
Can I ask, in this, in 10 years, there's planning all around home. I was in some of the shops I thought, but in the initial non-traditional mortgage issuance, the OTS in their letter had a particular caveat in there about certain, the examiner discretion will need to be used because there are certain products and certain originators that have focused in niches. I should have the exact quote, but it was kind of this statement that kind of said, we're going to look at this on a case-by-case basis.
Right.
What was that dynamic? We've gotten some information from Dugan that looks at kind of a survey of the national banks that, a lot of this stuff really wasn't originated in the national banks. Kind of what were the dynamics between the agencies, because this was an agency.
Yeah, I mean, I don't, it's sort of like... at least from my view, we weren't looking at, is it your agency that's originating this, or is it my agency that's originating? We were just concerned about the market overall. And so we weren't necessarily trying to point fingers at, okay, you're responsible. This is really about originating guidance for examiners overall on what the right thing to do is and how to manage these risks. And that was the goal of the, you know, and afterwards, you know, people came back and said, well, this isn't in our shop, it was in your shop. But, you know, and the way things work, you know, people are, if, you know, a bank is linked to another activity, examiners are going to look at everything. So, you know, the OCC would often ask us about, you know, their sort of relationship with the non-banks, a bank's relationship with a non-bank subsidiary. So, you know, this whole thing about it's not in our backyard, it's in their backyard. And the same goes for the Fed. We all work together on it, and so I think there needs to be joint responsibility, not point fingers.
Yeah.
And negotiations, the OTS did give us a lot of pushback, from what I remember, on a number of guidances on both non-traditional, the subprime, and then the CRE guidance in particular. They gave us a lot of pushback.
When you say the OTS, is there a specific individual that you worked with there, or how did you get the sense the OTS was not?
Well, it was basically, you know, kind of the individuals themselves were, I think, reasonable people, but, you know, we all have to follow orders. Mm-hmm. And so they were just following marching orders.
But was there like an office that you? I mean, who communicated with you that you knew?
The policy area. Okay. I know the OTS. Yeah.
Okay. Can I ask about another sort of feature? I think in the second version of the guidance that addressed subprime non-traditional mortgage / subprime. Mm-hmm. There's specific language about this will apply to holding companies.
Mm-hmm.
Was that on purpose?
Yes.
Negotiation. Hey, Fed. Does it has to deal with non-bank subsidiaries?
That was a specific topic I remember discussing, and we intentionally put it in there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Was there any particular institution you were thinking about when you put that in there?
Countrywide.
Yeah. You earlier made a couple references to Congress having some concerns with the issuance of some of this non-traditional guidance.
Mm-hmm.
Was that, were those concerns expressed in written comment letters?
No, that was commentary, no more, you know, verbal. But it was on the CRE we did get written commentary on that.
Okay, going back to the verbal part, how would you, a staff person at the Board of Governors, hear about a Congress person having concerns? How did that play out?
You know, we hear about these things from when we get comments from the industry back, specific written comments, and then, you know, our congressional liaison people, you know, that's how we heard it back. That's how we heard.
And what was the nature of the concern that you heard about?
It was really stifling innovation. So the philosophy was market discipline should take care of these sorts of anomalies or bad practices. And we don't want, you know, too much prescription in the regulation, because it stifles innovation, and innovation is good for the overall financial markets and overall economy. That was the philosophy. And, you know, there were many people that prescribed to that. And so, and mortgage being a $10 trillion market, you know, this could have a major impact on the, you know, growth of certain markets. And it did, in fact, immediately you know, have an impact on the types of securitizations being done. So, you know, banks started really, I think Wells, for instance, they immediately started testing the ability to repay and did the first securitization, basically saying that they looked at all the loans and made sure that there was an ability to repay. And that became a standard. That is now a standard in the securitization markets.
If it ever, how long did that take to evolve?
So it took 2 to 3 years because, you know, from the point of actually doing the survey and being concerned and finally issuing the guidance after all the negotiating, you know, that's a long process.
And then ultimately you were describing Wells, for example, and
yeah,
actually changed
yes
their underwriting standards.
They basically said that in this securitization, we tested the ability to repay.
But that was, what year was that, 2007?
Mm-hmm. Six or seven, yeah.
Can you ask how far the survey went?
Mm-hmm.
I understand you were surveying origination practices,
mm-hmm.
But I'd also like to take it to that next step, which you're now talking about, so I think this is a good transition,
mm-hmm.
on taking it to securitization.
Mm-hmm.
Did your survey address as well what kind of due diligence folks were doing before securitizing loans which they purchased from other originators,
yeah,
for instance? I mean, did the survey go that next step, or was there another survey to address the repackaging or securitization of loans as opposed to just
origination? We had a section on the guidance related to securitization specifically, and that I wanted that in there. And I can't say for our survey focused on the repackaging of it, because the premise was if you have good loans to begin with, then the repackaging is a second order situation. But if you have bad loans, no matter how many ways you repackage it, it's going to be garbage in, garbage out. And so our focus was on making sure the underwriting was done prudently, and then everything else will fit into place, because it's not the securitization structure itself that caused the problem. It was the underlying asset quality and some of the assumptions behind the new technology, the CDO squares, that was the problem.
Can I ask you a question on underwriting?
Mm-hmm.
You had talked about this earlier. Do you remember when you first,
mm-hmm.
without yourself digging mm-hmm. down to look at it,
mm-hmm.
but when did you first start to worry?
Well, there were so many things going on. I think, you know, it wasn't just myself. There were a lot of people that I think were legitimately concerned about it, and I think some of my colleagues at the OCC really, you know, talked about it a lot. And then there were rumblings around the system, and so, you know, that's kind of how.
When? How early?
I would say, you know, 2004 or 2005. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's primarily from the underwriting standpoint.
Yeah, the underwriting standpoints, exactly. And then before that,
can you say from that point what was accumulating that you all were talking about, that made you all talk about it? Just the evidence from
the underwriting. So we had issued, before the non-traditional mortgage guidance, we had issued the HELOC guidance.
Yeah.
So it was the rapid increase in home prices,
mm-hmm.
Rapid increase in the origination of HELOCs,
mm-hmm.
and underwriting deterioration there as well. So we issued, so mortgages was a concern back in 2004, I think we issued that. That was interagency. So then after that, we started focusing on the first mortgages, because the HELOCs were second, that was the riskier, and it was just growing like gangbusters. And so we issued that in 2004, and through that, I think, and obviously if you issue something in 2004 or early 2005, my numbers, so don't, this is not, I'm trying to mislead you, but it's just my memory is failing me. More now than before, but So I think it's as early as 2003 we might have been talking about it, and then, you know, it takes time to get together, and then we issued it back in 2005 or late 2004 or early 2005.
And how far up the chain did the concern go?
The HELOC didn't go up as high. It was sort of, okay, it made sense, let's issue it.
Mm-hmm. You're talking about sort of an underlying unease or concern with the nature of the mortgage market in general? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, that, I think the underlying need, really, I think the concern started in, I heard, in, 2005. Four or five, yeah.
And I guess, did that go all the way up? Maybe you've discussed this earlier, you know, to the Board of Governors.
Yeah. So, you know, you look at the home price appreciation, and the chairman was very concerned about that. So I think some of his monetary or interest rate decisions were in part to slow down that market. I'm not sure if that's the case or not.
But those were discussions at the time.
There were meetings, obviously the home price appreciation was a big concern. Mm-hmm. The sort of the interest rate tool wasn't working. And so, you know, the supervision arm was being supported by Greenspan, because he really was a market discipline kind of person. And so he really didn't want supervision to play a very heavy role in the markets unless he had to.
Do you ever remember any kind of, I'm fishing totally, but a kind of a discussion or meeting or presentation in which all the Fed tools were discussed beyond just interest rates?
No. I wasn't part of that meeting, at least.
In your capacity as we're setting the guidelines for examiners and risk, in the time frame from 2003 through 2007, were examiners ever given any guidance or concern, or were you concerned, to your knowledge, about commercial banks extending warehouse lines to originators that were non-banks. Mm-hmm. Sort of the new sentries out there that weren't under your watch, but perhaps were being funded by institutions that were very much under your watch. Mm-hmm. Was that a topic of conversation or concern in yourself?
Let me think about that. So the way we looked at it was the bank protected against the credit risk of that counterparty? So if Citi was to extend a warehousing line to IndyBank, did it reserve appropriately for the risk at the end of the day? Did they identify the risk of lending to IndyBank, and were they going to get their money back?
Were you looking at it at all with an aggregate view? You mentioned, before the William process and procedures as opposed to individual transactions.
Right.
Across the market.
Across the market came, right. Not specific. I can't specifically say we targeted warehousing loans specifically. But the aggregate view came from the survey and our understanding that the non-banks were, non-regulated entities were a big part of originating those mortgages. We didn't go back and say, well, aha, the banks are funding them. Our concern was, make sure these loans that you're originating are good, prudent loans. And so our view was that once that is taken care of, then all these other pieces will fall into place. But if this is done improperly, then everything else breaks down. So it was really focusing on the foundation. You build, make sure the foundation is strong, then all these interconnectivities, if you will not have, won't be as much of an issue.
Can Can we kind of talk about the monitoring sort of in the aggregate?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've presented really good history on this sort of bottoms-up approach and what's going on in underwriting.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of this stuff was being securitized
mm-hmm.
in different instruments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, RMBS was mm-hmm. created, CDOs were created.
Mm-hmm.
The Fed had a focus, and I don't have the year,
mm-hmm.
where we started looking at markets.
Mm-hmm.
We focused more on stock prices,
mm-hmm.
Volatility, CDS spreads, and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What was your group monitoring those mm-hmm. sort of aggregate level
yeah.
statistics?
Mm-hmm.
Were there any indicators, you know, spreads in CDOs or, you know, that?
Well, what was yeah. happening is we were concerned about the spreads being so thin. And, and whether the spreads were justified, whether the risk of the underlying instruments justified the spreads. That was always a concern. And the Fed economists, as well as us, we tried to answer that question. And I don't think we ever came up with a very good answer to that.
Can you give some specificity
yeah.
to that
yeah.
as to which instruments had thin spreads that you were concerned about and perhaps what was...
So the leveraged loan market, for instance, highly levered transactions were trading almost at investment grade type spreads from a historical perspective. You obviously had the AAA securities, which were, I think, what, 5 or 6 basis points, or some 2 or 3 basis points in some cases. Around there. So we did look at that and tried to understand whether the pricing made sense for the risk.
And you mentioned earlier
mm-hmm.
as well, I think it was one of your first potential, or one of your first contributing causes to the crisis
mm-hmm.
was this belief that this reliance on AAA
mm-hmm.
securities as being safe.
Mm-hmm.
And I see we're back there
mm-hmm.
and noticing the thin spreads.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about the Fed's what the Fed did to explore that and any conclusions that were drawn as to the very
mm-hmm.
Clear perception that there wasn't a lot of risk in the
game. Yeah. So the way that examiners looked at it was safety to the banking system, right? And so they tried to see where all this excess liquidity was coming from that was driving these spreads to be so low. And one key area was the hedge funds, the non-bank industry, which was providing non-banks, non-regulated entities, that was providing a lot of liquidity to the system. And so we looked at whether banks were, there was a horizontal conducted, whether banks were actually lending to those institutions in a safe and sound manner. And our conclusion was yes. So, the issue around, at the end of the day, if the spreads were too low for the risk, then there would be unexpected losses from the assets where the banks were not reserving properly, because the spreads, in a way, reflect the expected losses, right? So if your spread is too low, that means you're going to have unexpected losses that are not priced into the into the loan, right? So that means, so let's say you have you charge 100 basis points for LIBOR plus 100. So your expected losses over the life of the loan is supposed to be, 100 basis points per year over the life of the loan. But the actual loss ends up being 200 basis points. That means you're undercharging. And so are the banks reserving and protecting themselves appropriately? And we found that, yes, they were. And just looking at the hedge fund industry, and that proved to be correct, because the hedge fund industry was, you know, and the bank's losses from the hedge fund industry was okay at the end of the day.
Well, can we talk about that a little? Because the hedge funds were largely trading in lower profitable tranches, and so people were expecting there might be some defaults at that level.
Right.
But can we stay on the AAA risk and maybe even look at a very specific example, Seabrook, which was holding 30-plus billion of AAA risk on its own balance sheet. So presumably within, solidly within the supervisory authority of the Fed. What was the Fed thinking regarding the thin spreads on that? And was there any thinking about, you mentioned that whether there were losses was your measurement, but by definition, there are no losses if nobody's trading, if everybody's holding. So can you talk a little about the thinking behind that?
Some of the thinking there was that they were highly protected in terms of the over-collateralization, the securitization. It's, you know, the pricing at the end of the day, you know, in terms of potential losses, will the losses actually start eating into the tranche? And the prevailing view at the time was no, it would not eat into the tranche. And part of what happened at Citigroup was the technical factors that drove prices to go down as opposed to fundamental credit factors. So if you look at the actual outcome of the cash flows versus the prices that a lot of these banks had to go through, it wasn't necessarily aligned. There was a significant pullback in liquidity for AAA tranches, whether you're a conventional mortgage or everybody lumped the securitization markets together. They didn't differentiate between, you know, the high quality AAA versus the toxic AAA.
Well, let me stay on that for a minute. Was that in any way foreseeable? Because the other folks holding other than Citi were your pension funds and your 27A funds that absolutely would have to dump.
Yeah.
The minute the prices started to go down. So was that in a way foreseeable from the aggregate level?
In hindsight, I would say it's foreseeable.
Okay.
In hindsight. Okay. But
well, let's go back to the...
At that time, no. I mean, I didn't, my group did not. That wasn't a focus of mine. That was not, that was more in the market risk side. So mine was on the credit risk side.
The market risk, I'm sorry.
The market risk was my friend Jim Emberson. So mine was, my focus was looking at the underlying asset quality and then understanding the behavior on the volatility of the securities. That's a market risk component, which, you know, that's that I that was not my responsibility.
But it's a combination.
It's a combination. So the credit, the deterrence. So that's why my focus was making sure that the underlying quality of the assets are solid, and then everything else would fall into place. Unfortunately, what happened was the pullback in the liquidity in the market also caused a huge drop in the prices, which didn't necessarily reflect the real sort of losses, right? So if the liquidity of an instrument drops from significantly, you know, a 5-point drop, that's what a AAA security, and you have hundreds of millions of that, that's a big hit on your mark-to-market portfolio. And that's what partly caused the problem.
This is late
07? 07, that's right. So when the commercial paper market started pulling back because a lot of some of these mortgage companies had problems, like IndyMac and other, and Countrywide that was having problems, then the whole market pulled back and caused a huge drop in prices, not necessarily reflecting the credit fundamentals. And Citi and other institutions had a large part of that. They also had a big part of a large amount of actual toxic assets. But the mark-to-market hit on their capital because of this, you know, pullback in liquidity was enormous.
Let me ask you, you make an excellent point about the distinction between market markets.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were to hold it mm-hmm. the 7 or 8 years
mm-hmm.
to the CDO's maturity, whether you would in fact be whole.
Mm-hmm.
So did the Fed look at that? Do we know today in 2010
mm-hmm.
if people are taking real losses as opposed to their mark-to-mark losses? Because presumably people took their losses in 2007,
yeah.
So we wouldn't see it on their...
So we made that evaluation of the stress test that we conducted. So last year, the stress test for the banking system. So we looked at the credit quality of these instruments and tried to really determine the true losses that they were going to take. So we did take that into account, and as a result...
After the meltdown,
yeah.
I'm sorry, but what was that?
The result was, the conclusion was in some cases they would. I mean, it was somewhere in between. Yes, not all of it. It was sort of in between, the market's expectation of prices and what the actual losses was going to end up being.
Remember, right at the time of the stress test as well, the FASB came out with a new OTTI definition,
mm-hmm.
which is, I hate this word, bifurcated the credit versus the market component. So
but that was a good lot. Yeah, follow that through to a conclusion what that means. Or, I'm not a quant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Nothing about me is quant-like. So, so you put that sort of in plain English for me.
Yeah.
Does that mean at the end of the day the stress tests were wrong? And the methodologies were wrong, and the super seniors would get hit.
Well, which stress test are you? Well, the stress test we conducted a year ago?
Well, I don't know. The question is, I'm just trying to figure out what the conclusion is in hindsight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. In hindsight, yeah, go ahead.
I think you're asking about when the rating agencies stressed these and looked at loss levels.
Well, that's how you got the AAA rating, right?
Yes.
And absolutely, thank you.
Yes.
You mentioned that.
Yeah, they were wrong. They were wrong. Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, it looks that way, but
yeah.
I don't know. I wasn't there.
And the reason was, there was one reason. My understanding of a key factor was the correlation assumptions in structuring of those securities. What they assumed was, particularly in the subprime and the alt-A sector, they assumed that if you had geographical diversity. Not all of them would sort of default at the same time, and that's actually what didn't pan out to be true. That was one key factor among others, I believe.
And I guess what I would also want to know is,
yeah.
Okay, so the rating agencies got a few things wrong.
Yeah.
I want to go back to what the Fed was doing with the rating agencies to evaluate whether they could rely on that.
Yeah. So
the rating agencies kind of covered because they disclosed that you can't rely on us.
So I actually my team went to New York several times to visit the rating agencies and ask them about their view about, these,
To the extent you could try to, every once in a while, talk in a date so that we know if we're...
Yeah. So this was back in, again, 2004 and 5. We went to the rating agencies and started asking them about, these sort of... We went to S&P and Moody's, yes. Not all three, but S&P and Moody's. And I asked them about, these disturbing trends. And, some senior folks from there thought that it was a blip. It wasn't actually a secular change. It was temporary. And so the rating agency strongly felt that...
Were you asking senior managers, quants? Who were you sort of... You could
combination. Yeah. They were actually involved in the structuring. And the structuring people were also involved in the sales, too.
Can I ask you a question about this visit?
Mm-hmm.
When the Federal Reserve
make the effort to transport themselves from Washington, D.C. to New York to pay a visit. I would assume that you got permission. Did you have to clear that with somebody in D.C.? In other words, okay, so you decided to do it.
Yeah.
And you wanted to rent, you were making an effort to get their attention, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so
it's a signal.
You could have done this on the phone,
it's
a video conference.
It's clearly a signal. Okay. It was an attempt to go there and say, because I could have done it, I went there myself with some people and give them a signal. The regulators are concerned. Absolutely.
So, and they
so
do.
That, would you say it was the raised eyebrow from British?
More than that.
This is something that Ludwig has said that regulators can.
Yeah,
the eyebrow. This was definitely a signal.
Yeah, it was definitely a signal to go there and ask them. And I wasn't. I mean, I can't say for sure, okay, I'm going to go there and really try to give them a signal. But I knew that that by people from the Fed going there, it would raise their eyebrows, and so to speak. And clearly it did, because it got the attention of a lot of senior people when we were there.
Except the answer was, it's a blip.
The underlying message was it was temporary, and
And did they offer you some data and information? You asked for some substantiation of this. Why their thesis was this was a blip?
Yeah, I think they showed some evidence that look, things are turning around here, and so I remember seeing something.
And what did you think when you saw it?
I wasn't completely convinced, but it didn't lower my radar screen. It didn't say, "Oh, okay, great, we'll be fine." I was not relieved, but I mean, rating agencies at the time still had a lot of credibility. So I continued. We didn't say, "Okay, rating agency says fine, let's relax." That's not what came out of it.
Can we add a little? I don't think I have a appropriate foundation to process what you said. You took over your role in 2001. The Fed does not oversee the credit rating agencies. So, had you ever made a visit before?
To the credit rating agencies? I didn't make a visit, but I would talk to them.
You would talk to them?
Yeah.
Do you know if others have visited them, had this type of meeting before?
I'm sure others have, but I don't think, at least from the board, there wasn't that many.
And how many did you? How many folks did you take with you when you went?
Two or three. Two maximum. Sorry, three overall. Not more than two.
Okay.
Anyone from the New York Fed meet you there?
No. This was a policy issue, and I wanted to sort of do our own digging.
How much did any of this visit and this field trip exist on paper?
I'm sure it exists, but I don't know if they threw it away or not.
Who?
My staff.
Oh, you don't archive that kind of thing just routinely. It would be. What do you mean? It would be thrown away?
Possibly.
Well, I think did you do some sort of report memo?
There was some memo. There was a memo.
And who was the memo, two or four?
There was an internal memo put in our files. And then, we would verbally communicate our meeting with management. This is what the rating agencies have said. We didn't actually send out a report saying, okay, we met with the rating agencies here. So we said we're in New York, and here's what they say.
Did you write a memo?
No.
Did you edit a memo? Review?
I looked at it. I mean, the guy was with me was quite capable. So.
Can you tell us who wrote it?
I think it was Brian Valenti. He's still there.
So when you say you got their attention, let's go back to that.
Yeah.
You got their attention.
Yeah.
And how did that begin to play out that you got their attention?
How did it play out?
Yeah. What was the evidence of that?
Oh, just by the line of questioning, we're sort of, when the Fed goes there and meets with people and asks questions about trends and delinquencies and their assumptions and, you know.
But do you think that it changed anything for them?
Well, I don't think it had a material impact.
I think I may be lacking a few more foundations here. When you paid your visit to them and had the conversation, and I think this just sort of came out, but I don't want to misinterpret you, it sounds like you were going to specifically talk about the increasing delinquency rate in securities they had rated. Is that what you were doing?
Right, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Because they're, yeah.
And can you...
Not specific securities, but overall.
Absolutely, right.
Right.
Trends in the market.
Right.
And were you talking about RMBS and CDOs?
We're talking about securitization in general.
So you were talking in general that there was a trend of increasing delinquencies in securities they had rated that perhaps were higher, that indicated the ratings were wrong? Is that right?
Yeah, implicitly.
Okay, well, I don't want to make that up, but that's not what you were there to talk about.
We didn't directly say, hey, your ratings are wrong.
No.
We went in there, what are your views? Are you planning for more downgrades, which implies that their original ratings were wrong?
But I just want to understand the view of your team when you went there.
Yeah.
Was your view that these ratings may not have been right from the get-go?
There was an element of that. I mean, we were concerned about the poor underwriting and what impact they had on the securities. And then S&P being so close to looking at mortgages themselves, we wanted to validate whether our view about the sort of deteriorating underwriting standard and deteriorating quality of loans was consistent with theirs. And if it was consistent, then they would have concluded that there's going to be massive downgrades. And so what came out was they were not as concerned as we were.
And if we can stay on that and GitGo is we can stay on that for a moment. Did you discuss with them at that meeting or previously what they did, what S&P and Moody's did specifically to what their due diligence process was in looking at the origination of the loans which they were rating?
Yeah, I think we had that conversation, yes.
And can you tell me about that conversation? What you learned, what you knew, as to what sort of due diligence, if any, that the rating agencies were doing on the primary underwriting of, because it doesn't come to them until it's packaged.
Right. So they basically looked at the FICO scores, the LTVs, you know, where the properties were located, things of that nature.
And did you discuss with them whether they were looking at, you know,
DTIs
for granted that they were correct, or whether they were actually doing due diligence? As, you know, Citigroup would expect to do due diligence.
Well, they said that these were, you know, the warranties or guarantees were provided by the institution that originated them.
Meaning what to you? There was no need to do due diligence because...
I don't actually remember. I can't remember going down that deep, quite frankly.
Were you aware in 2004, 2005, when you had this visit, that S&P and Moody's did no due diligence on the loan tapes they got?
I don't think they go out, and that was my impression. I don't think they actually go out and kick the tires.
Was it that aware in 2004 and 2005 that, again, they got the loan tapes and they said, okay, here's...
Yeah, I think that was my understanding.
You understand?
I think that was my...
During this meeting and sort of an observation of what you described as some disturbing trends...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was my understanding. It may not have been the Fed's understanding.
Fair enough.
I want to differentiate the two.
I make that disclosure all the time. My views are certainly not necessarily the views of the commission or the staff thereof.
Right.
But when you had this meeting and you having the understanding that they didn't kick the tires when they made those assessments and put those ratings on those instruments, was there a discussion that maybe it was time to start kicking the tires?
No.
Okay. Did you think that?
No, no, because the kicking of the tires, my personal view was should have been done at the bank level. Mm-hmm. The rating agencies are not equipped to do that. Mm-hmm. They have to change their whole model. Mm-hmm. What they should be doing is to say, okay, you know, does our assumptions on the default rate on no-doc loans make sense? Mm-hmm. Right? Does our collateralization rate, does the structure, does our... you know, correlation assumptions make sense. So let's validate that based on the data that we get. That's, you know, they're sort of the quants that sort of, you know, model things out. They're not the ones to actually go and kick the people that are kicking the tires should be the banks that took responsibility or the institutions that took responsibility to originate them. And then they said, here are the loans. These are, you know, of X quality. And then the rating agencies takes those loans and structures it based on, you know, key variables that drive default rates, which are LTV, you know, DTIs and FICO scores, if possible.
Any discussion, and I take your point, you know, that garbage in, garbage out, and you have a solid foundation, you're likely to have a house that doesn't fall down.
Yeah.
But any discussion about, okay, so we have a reason to believe there's a lot of bad product out there.
Yeah.
Maybe we should take a step back before we securitize it all and pass it on.
Right, yeah. There was a discussion among senior regulators, and I was there, and we had that discussion about this whole concept of distribution, originate to distribute, and whether banks need to take responsibility for originating good loans, even though at the end of the day they're selling it off to the markets.
When was the meeting with CFA regulators?
Okay, this is within the Fed. This was back in, I think, back in 2006.
That was after going to talk to the rating agencies, right?
It was around there, yeah.
Around that same time.
Mm-hmm.
And then what happened at that meeting?
There was 50% agreed, 50% didn't.
Before, I want to hear all the things that you jumped in on that, but can I, so we can tie a bow around the visit to New York, was Brian Clarkson involved in any of those conversations?
Brian Clarkson?
Yep. At Moody's.
I got that
I'm
name,
to
yeah.
Do you know if you've ever met him?
You know, the names, I cannot remember. I recognize the face.
Fair enough. The following, and this could be the last question.
Yeah.
Do you remember any of the people you spoke to from S&P or from Moody's?
The actual names?
Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned that you spoke to them on it.
Yeah. There was one guy we would talk to a lot, and he came. You know, the FDIC organized this meeting about what to do in securitizations and how to restructure. He was the guy that came, so we would deal with him a lot. I'm sorry, I forget his name. I can try to dig it up for you if you want.
And the final thing on the rating agencies. Yeah. You mentioned that prior to this visit, you did talk to them.
Sorry, can I just take this phone? Yeah. Hello? Hi. So, I'm in a meeting. Let me just see. Can you tell me how much longer this will be?
We're just discussing that.
You have a hard stop, so that.
Yeah, I have to meet someone at around 11:30.
It's now.
Yeah.
Can we wrap up in 15 minutes?
Charles, how are you doing? Are you? Can you? You want me to meet you back at the at your? I'm sorry. Can I meet you back at your office so you're not late? You know, before your 1 o'clock. I'll call you on your cell. All right. Thanks. Bye.
2 minutes. I hope you'll forgive me for this.
Mm-hmm.
I think we actually do have a fair number of questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that we have mm-hmm. another opportunity to speak with you?
Sure. Okay. Happy to help.
You really did have mm-hmm. a front row seat to a lot of things,
mm-hmm.
and I personally want to ask you some questions about a couple of these institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And I
that's good.
I don't want to ram through them in 10 seconds mm-hmm. and misinterpret anything you have to say.
Sure.
But with that, I will be very quiet if Steve wants to talk for another 15 minutes.
No,
knowing that he'll come back.
Right.
Yeah.
If we
could
reschedule, then...
Sure. Sherry can arrange something.
Okay.
Thanks.
And
sure. No, my pleasure.
We've got a whole set of questions.
Yeah.
Structure
around.
Oh,
yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
No, I'm happy to give my view. You know, I don't want to blame anybody for anything or... You know, the Fed's a great institution and so the other regulator. You know, we're all human, you know.
That's right.
But, I mean, in hindsight, I think we've learned some lessons, and...
And
that's the important thing.
I don't think...
Yeah. I hope, you know, we hope, right.
I mean, I know from my personal standpoint, yeah. I don't speak for the Commission, it's not about blame, it's about understanding.
Yeah.
You know, history allows us to recognize our mistakes and make them again. It's just about understanding and figuring out...
Right.
And it's also about explaining, you know, part of our job is to explain to the American public what happened. And
yeah.
I think we all agree they have a right to know.
Yes.
So it's about understanding mm-hmm. and putting that in English.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can
schedule. Yeah, sure.
Thank
you so much. My pleasure. Sorry.
Okay, we're going to turn this off.
Hello. 11:00. All right.